not just a bill on Capitol Hill.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. There is a palpable sense of urgency this morning in the halls of Congress. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson are on the Hill to testify about this $700 billion bailout of the financial industry. The hearing just got underway a few minutes ago with the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Christopher Dodd.
American taxpayers are angry, and they demand to know how we arrived at this moment, and more importantly, right now, how the architects of this economic landscape will put us back on a sound financial footing and restore American confidence and optimism.
Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us what we might expect from Congress.
In their own bills, lawmakers have pushed to limit CEO compensation, change bankruptcy laws to help homeowners, and give taxpayers an equity stake in the companies they help. All these provisions make Wall Street bankers a bit uneasy. But Congress has also taken some steps they like. Scott Talbot's a lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable.
Who can participate and what assets are eligible for purchase by Treasury are the heart of the matter, and they're still a little bit in flux.
He says one version of the bailout bill allows the feds to buy any troubled assets from banks, not just mortgage loans.
Are auto loans included? Are student loans included? Are credit card loans included?
I mean, troubled assets seems pretty broad.
It is.
But it's not a done deal.
So there's still some uncertainty.
And Talbot and financial markets around the world are listening closely as Bernanke, Paulson, and Congress hash out the details and try to end the uncertainty. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Investors seem to like what they hear so far. The Dow is up 100 points in the early going to 11,118. The NASDAQ has climbed 21, and the S&P 500 is up 13 points. In Asia today, the markets closed lower, 2 to 3%. European shares are down 1 to 2% so far. I saw this great editorial cartoon this morning. President Bush is standing in a pile of rubble, shouting into a bullhorn, "People of Galveston!" And then his aide taps him on the shoulder and says, "Sir, this is Wall Street." I think that about sums it up. But Texas is trying to recover from Hurricane Ike. A lot of people in Houston still don't have power 10 days later. Ed Mayberry reports from KUHF in Houston.
It's cleanup time for Rodney Nix. His South Houston bar had been shut down because of the lack of power, and he's anxious to see his customers again.
They want to relax, come and talk about their, you know, what happened to them and everything, and they'll gather around and we'll hear their bunch of stories, you know.
Centerpoint Energy's been working around the clock for over a week to restore electricity for nearly 2 million customers. The outages affect traffic signals, creating commuting nightmares. The lack of power is affecting how fast gasoline refineries can ramp up production. The Port of Houston says normal operations have resumed, although the port's Tom Cornegay says it's too early to calculate the economic impact.
I just don't have a number right today. We were down almost a week.
Galveston's port is still shut down, and tomorrow marks the first time most Galveston residents will be allowed back on the island to survey damage. From Houston, I'm Ed Mayberry for Marketplace.
This is the Morning Report for Tuesday, September 23rd on Marketplace.org. President Bush gives his final speech to the United Nations today. He'll certainly talk about what's happened on Wall Street and the need for a global response to this financial meltdown. Bob Moon has more.
There's no sign that other major global powers will draw up their own financial rescue packages, despite the Bush administration's plea that they pitch in. President Bush may be more likely to receive a lecture than an offer to pony up when his French counterpart follows him on the General Assembly podium today. It was almost a year ago that Nicolas Sarkozy challenged U.S. lawmakers to do something about financial excess as he addressed Congress through an interpreter.
Those who love this nation, which more than any other has demonstrated the virtues of free enterprise, expect her to commit fully to the establishment of the necessary rules and safeguards.
And British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is already sounding more interested in cracking down on financial excess than joining in a global bailout. Brown spoke to the BBC.
I think what people haven't appreciated is we've now got global financial systems, but we've only got national regulators to cover them.
Brown is vowing to renew his push for cross-border banking regulation when he addresses the UN Thursday. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The UN delegates from Africa are worried the current economic situation could lead to a pullback in aid to their countries. Gretchen Wilson has this report from Johannesburg.
World leaders say if rich nations stall on their financial commitments to Africa, the global financial crisis will threaten efforts to improve the lives of hundreds of millions of the world's poorest. In 2005, rich donor nations agreed to increase aid to Africa to cut extreme poverty. But UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says these countries have largely failed to deliver on their promises. Right now, aid is especially needed to feed millions in Ethiopia and to rebuild Zimbabwe's economy. Ban is calling on industrialized countries to spend a total of $72 billion a year to help African nations. He says the price tag is daunting but affordable. The amount is one-tenth of the package Washington's considering to rescue Wall Street firms. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
The price of oil is back down again this morning. It's at $107 a barrel. Yesterday, oil shot way up. It was up around $120 for a while. Our European correspondent Stephen Beer joins us. Stephen, what in the world's going on with oil?
Well, one key factor yesterday was that Monday was the deadline for buying oil for October delivery. So there was a bit of a last-minute rush, plus the uncertainty about the bailout of the banking system that, it is suggested, drove speculators into oil as a safe haven. Well, it's not looking so much of a safe haven today.
Yeah, but we're quite a bit above where we were last week, which was around $90 a barrel. So what is the underlying supply and demand situation right now?
It looks to be a little bit tighter than many market operators were expecting. The story which brought oil down from $147 a barrel was slowing economies in the US and Europe particularly. But of course, we've had earlier this month OPEC's decision to cut production by 500,000 barrels a day and, of course, output shutdowns and damage to infrastructure caused by Hurricane Ike and Gustav. And that has reduced supply and put upward pressure on the price of oil.
All right, Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Scott.
Today we begin a new election series called Interested Parties. We're looking at the economic concerns of voters. We'll begin with Nandini Panja, who came to the U.S. in 1983 to work as a computer programmer. She's been a citizen for more than 10 years now and lives in Milford, Connecticut.
I grew up in India. I lived there until my early 20s. I didn't have to go far to see people living with less, doing with less. So my politics is driven by making sure everybody has a chance at a living wage and a decent life. That, to me, is the priority. Vis-a-vis the economy, I would like the next administration to at least accept that Americans have a right to expect to be employed in their own country. Until and unless we have consensus on that, we don't have a hope of coming up with policies that can make that happen. I think government has a big role to play. To give you an example, if we did not have a minimum wage law, I have no doubt in my mind that employers would try to get people to work for less than the minimum wage. I'm not necessarily saying that people in other places are ignorant or anything, but clearly we have a system where a lot of thought has gone into rectifying some of these things that we don't really think about. So yes, government does have a role to play.
Voter Nandini Panja of Milford, Connecticut. She represents one group of voters, immigrants. Now we'll hear from a different group, war veterans. Almost 2 million people have returned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One in five of them doesn't have a job. One in four makes less than $22,000 a year. Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The military promises training opportunities and a lifetime of experience.
The Army takes you to your strongest point. And whatever you do after that, you'll just keep getting stronger. I make $10.75 an hour here, and then $11 an hour at the other job.
Michael Devon is a 24-year-old Army veteran. After 5 years as a military police officer, he wound up as a security guard at a JCPenney in Annapolis, Maryland. He also stocks groceries. Devon wanted a job as a civilian police officer, but he had a hard time explaining the value of his Army experience in job interviews. Veteran Paul Rykoff has heard that before. He's founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Rykoff says the military does train troops to use high-tech weaponry.
A young 19-year-old, 20-year-old could be responsible for literally millions of dollars worth of equipment.
Rykoff says the problem is what comes next. He says veterans need help with everything, from treatment for post-traumatic stress syndrome to getting bigger home and small business loans, and most of all, finding jobs.
If you're a 19-year-old machine gunner and you come out of the 82nd Airborne, there's not a lot of work done to mentor that young soldier, to help them market themselves in the corporate world and help them transition.
Rykoff says vets need help explaining how experience as a gunner or tank driver would be valuable in a civilian job. The Pentagon does require all departing troops to attend short job hunting courses. But former Marine officer Narelle Helmer says her 4-day course mainly involved how to enroll for VA benefits.
After that 4 days, you're on your own. It's just fending for yourself in a stressful environment and a failing economy.
So Helmer went to a private job fair in Virginia for officers leaving the military. Former Army Captain Thomas Sullivan was also there. He says the government offers plenty of help, like online college courses troops can take from anywhere.
There is a good chance that a lot of soldiers don't take advantage of the particular assets out there. That's really on them.
Advocates like Paul Rykoff say that's easy for officers with higher degrees to say. He says rank-and-file troops need serious government support to see action on the civilian job front. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Share your own economic concerns as the election approaches at our website, marketplace.org. Just click on the link, Interested Parties. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.